morning, everyone. Welcome. Welcome to the workshop, ICMC workshop. We have three tracks today. So this is track number two on that, I guess. And here, you're here to hear all about how not to do FIPS, and then a surprise portion, how to do FIPS at the end of it, right? How to do it right. First, you learn how not to do it, and then you learn how to do it correctly. So welcome again, and could you close the door as well at the end of it? So we have about a three-hour session, and we have two presenters, Chris Keenan and Steve Vanguard. They're both from Aruba.
Gossamer.
Oh, sorry. Aruba and Gossamer. Okay, good. And I'm Nitya Rajmarugu. I'm from one of the labs, local labs here. And you'll be seeing me more often all 3 days. I have a few announcements, right? The first one is about Wi-Fi. There is Wi-Fi available inside the room as well. Although we thought we were going to get it outside only, but we have it arranged inside as well. The Wi-Fi codes are on page 5 of the book, program. The second announcement is about local folks, whoever is driven in. If you have a parking ticket to be validated, the registration desk will do it for you, so you don't have to pay anything for parking. Lunch is at 12. Quarter after 12, quarter after 12 till 1:15, quarter after 1, and we would have to move down to the atrium. So that's where the lunch is for today. So all 3 days, they're at different places. Today it's at the atrium. And in between, I think Steve and Chris might give you a break if they see you sleeping, I guess, or dozing away. They might be kind enough to give us all a break in between. Okay, so welcome again, and Steve, here you go.
Well, good morning, everybody. Thank you for coming. We're going to do the talk in two parts today. Chris and I will start with how not to do a FIPS 140 project, and then we'll switch over and do some time on an intro to FIPS 140 in a way that you should do FIPS 140 projects. This first part is a little bit lighthearted. This tends to be a very serious subject, and too often we spend too much time being too serious. Let's try to think about it, but the thing is, all of the messages here are real. I've been a developer, a consultant, and a lab tester and a lab manager, so I've been pretty much all of the roles that you can have in FIPS 140 work, and I've been doing this for a while. Chris has been doing it for some time, and there are a lot of ways to do it wrong. And if you do it wrong, it's a lot harder and a lot more expensive than it has to be. So first, let's talk about all the ways not to do it. So first of all, why bother planning? Just go for it. Well, it's not so hard, right? Well, actually, FIPS isn't so much hard as it's exacting. You have to meet the requirements. The requirements are precise. So one of the things from the very start is understand this is not a soft piece of work you're doing. It's a very specific piece of work, and you want to make sure you get it right. So all these requirements, they're confusing. There's so many of them. Do I really need to learn all this stuff? Well, you need to understand it because they're not optional. No matter who you are, you have to meet the requirements, no matter what your module is going to be. It has to meet all of the FIPS 140 requirements to get your certificate of validation. So from the start, understand that you must meet the requirements. And that's the whole goal. We don't have to do anything crazy. We don't have to do things that are unexpected, because all of the requirements are clearly laid out, and you know what you need to do. And yes, they really make you do all those things. You have to do all the pieces. You have to complete all the requirements if you're going to get your certificate of validation. So from the beginning, understand that you're going to have to do these things, and you're probably going to have to get training. Any standard is complicated, and computer security standards tend to be some of the most complicated standards there are. So first of all, if you're not sure what you're doing, go get some training. There's a lot of opportunities. We'll talk about some more of that a little later, but understand that if you don't understand, you need to learn to understand. Okay, I don't need to read all that mess. What's this? Read the standard. It's a great way to fall asleep. Appendices, annexes, DTR, what's that? Well, you need to understand the requirements, like I just said, and these are the requirements. None of these documents are terribly fun to read, but they tell you how to do it. For example, approved functions, what are they? I mean, it's like, I can do my own crypto, right? Why do I have to use somebody else's? Well, no, designing crypto really is rocket science. I've known people who've designed crypto algorithms, and in fact, they were very, very smart people, and most of them still got it wrong. For those of you who watched when AES was chosen as the new standard for symmetric block encrypting algorithms, you'll understand how many people actually wrote algorithms, how they were tested publicly, how the code was reviewed publicly, and it ended up being a very good choice because it's a very good algorithm. Especially people who come up with proprietary algorithms and don't have them publicly tested, they're not likely to be very good. And so part of the reason that the approved functions were selected is so that you know what you're using and it's a good algorithm. Also interoperability. Other people just may want to decrypt what you encrypt. It's real nice if they can do that. Key generation, key management, key storage, what's all that mess? Again, it has to be done in a way that you can control where your keys are. It's 10 o'clock, do you know where your keys are? You have to be able to manage them. You have to be able to control access to them. These are also things that are part of the standard. In fact, some of the most important parts of the standard. So you need to know where your secrets are, how you erase them, that they are actually erased when you mean to erase them, and that they're managed and handled in an appropriate manner. Now, this is probably the one thing that most people new to FIPS 140 do as a mistake. They design and they develop product, and then they start going to do their validation. It's a real mistake. No problem, I'll just update it. Well, you know, even if your crypto module is an Android app, don't think of it as an Android app. This is not something that gets updated every 15 minutes. You're validating one version, exactly one version. If you make any changes to it, it needs to be revalidated. This is one of the most difficult things for people entering the FIPS 140 realm to understand, is that you can't keep sending out patches on your module every week and hold validation because it takes longer than that to revalidate it. So the thing about it is you have to make sure that you're going to do the, you know, when you start the FIPS process, you have to make sure you have something that's solid, and while it may need to get updated during the process, assume that once you have a crypto module, you're going to want to keep it stable for as long as you can. So you may end up wanting to choosing your crypto boundary, and that'll be much more about that later, is very important so you can change parts of your code that aren't related to your crypto without having to go through the revalidation process. So you can't put FIPS 140-2 on like a coat of paint. Security doesn't go on, it gets built in, baked in from the start. And so don't think you can slap it on at the end and get by, it won't work. So if I'm not gonna bother even thinking about FIPS until my product's all ready to go, why do I need to go get a lab first? Who are that, you know, that's just more money, time, other people involved in the project, other people's schedules I have to deal with. Well, the lab will help you prevent some of your mistakes, and you're gonna make them, everybody makes them. So the thing is, get the lab involved early. Also, yes, you are going to have to show them your code, all of your secrets. Now, some people say they don't trust the labs. Well, the truth is, any lab that isn't honest won't stay open for more than a day or two. Most of the labs have been around for years now. They all have great reputations. Understand that they have to review your code, they have to review your design, they have to see your schematics, they have to see your FPGA code, all of that. So understand that from the beginning, the lab is your partner. It's the lab works with you And if you don't think of your lab as a partner, it's going to be a fight, it's going to be uncomfortable, it's going to be unhappy. And we'll talk more about picking a lab, but build a good relationship with your lab. That's terribly important. Okay, there's security levels in FIPS. I want the best. My module is great. I want the highest level, don't I? No. Do you even know what the level 4 requirements are? They're hard. Do you know? I mean, do you know what formal modeling is? Do you feel like doing formal modeling on your code? If you've ever, most people I know who've done level 4 projects, the people who did the formal modeling for the code never recovered from it. It's sad, we go visit them now. But the truth is, pick the level that's appropriate for your module, for your industry. For example, I now work in the networking industry. It's pretty much standard that all networking hardware is validated at level 2. I don't know how it got there, but that's pretty much what's done. So that's a match. Okay, I understand that my products to be competitive and to fall in line with what everyone else is doing should be level 2. If I want to do something extra special and do level 3 so I could possibly use that as an advantage, I might want to. But the thing is, it's a careful consideration. It's not just, oh yeah, I want the highest one, because you're going to spend a lot more time and you may not even be successful. So if you're going to go for the highest levels, prepare for a serious effort, but don't do it if you don't need to. Use the source, Luke. I guess old Star Wars jokes may not be as good as they used to be. You have to document. You have to produce the documentation. Again, you have to look and see what is required. You know, again, I don't care if it's an Android app and that all, you know, almost all new software ships with no documentation at all and they just let the users muddle around and figure it out. That doesn't work. This doesn't work in this case. You have to provide proper documentation so that the administrator can properly configure the module into its secure FIPS 140 compliant configuration, and that the users can use it in that proper configuration. You need to supply documents, and luckily they're all laid out for you. Just read Appendix A of the standard. All the documents required are laid out quite carefully. As for you, who needs help? Well, unless you're smarter than all the, I see too many old faces in this room, and they're smirking, most of them, which is a good thing. Unless you're smarter than people who've been through this a whole bunch of times and still make mistakes, you're probably better off getting some help. It's not that it's that hard, it's just exacting, it's precise. You have to do things exactly the way they are stated. So, get training, and like I said, beginning, talk to your lab. Labs are usually one of the best places to get training. There are some other organizations that offer some training. If you do this, you learn it before your project's locked down. In fact, I was talking to someone in the hall about this before, and they were saying the security policy, one of the documents you have to produce, should really be produced at the same time as your architecture document, which really means before you start any serious development. Has anyone ever done that? Show of hands, anyone who's done FIPS 140? Wow, very unusual. Almost no one does that. Actually, I've never seen a first-timer who ever wanted to do that. And now, okay, I know that we do that because since we tend to spin our products, we just keep updating our documentation, which we know is all compliant, meets the requirements. But the truth is, most people start and they don't have their documentation in place. You will save yourself a lot of time and a lot of effort if you do that. And it's quick and easy, right? Okay, not even any groans, geez. The process is not really quick. Even if everything goes very smoothly and without any problems, it's still usually for a first-time project 4 to 6 months with the lab, and then there's the queue time at CMVP. That's currently, it's a little variable right now. It had been down as low as 3 months at the worst a number of years ago. It was up over a year. You have to be in line for the queue. Right now, I think it's between 3 and 6 months for most things. So you're talking about a year. It's a year investment, and so understand that your product's not going to have a certificate for a year, so if you want those customers that require it, specifically customers that have to meet FSMA or HSPD-12, you're going to have to plan significantly in advance. So make sure that you know that before you start, and make sure the people, your sales, I get questions from sales guys every single day of the week, and that includes both days on the weekends. What's the status? When's this coming out? And we have a page that says all these things, an internal web page, and yet I still get questions every day because the sales guys want to sell this, the customers want to buy it, but they need the certificate. Be aware that it takes some time, and be aware that there's no way around it. And if you need that certificate to sell to those customers, you have to plan for it. And now I'm going to hand it over to Chris because he's going to talk a little bit more from the lab view.
There's a lot of common themes in most of these slides, so we'll be touching on a lot of the what not to do, and that is pretty much repeated in about half the slides, just trying to drill that in. But when we move on to the what to do, you should see some new and additional topics. One topic will be entropy. Well, entropy is important, and it's something that if it's your first time through, you may not have thought about. You might be using an approved RNG. It might have a certificate. How is it seeded? What are the seed sources? How are you verifying that you're providing the right amount of entropy to your RNG? These are the things that you're going to have to prove. Evidence is going to have to be given to the lab. The lab's going to have to test your implementation, verify, and come up with rationale that will be accepted by the CMVP. And this is something that shouldn't be put off. And if it's put off until your product's already developed, you're going to go back and have to redevelop things likely, and it's going to delay schedules. And as Steve just talked about, the process already takes quite a long time, several months for testing, another up to 3 to 6 months for review process, and month or two after that for comments, and about a year process. So if you're not putting the development of the standard into your product at the beginning, your schedule is going to slip, and you're going to look at about a year delay. Oh, I should probably use the wrong button. Technical difficulties, apparently. But I didn't see that requirement. I've heard too many vendors say something along those lines. You probably had a customer come to you and ask you about where your FIPS certification was, and that might have been the first time you've heard about FIPS, and then you rushed and you got the standard and you had your development put the standard into your implementation. But if you haven't been working with a lab, if you haven't been developing your product from the start with FIPS in mind, you're most likely going to be missing actual requirements that aren't spelled out as directly in the standard, but are spelled out in the DTR, the Derived Test Requirements documents. That contains all of the assertions, the vendor evidence, and the test evidence requirements that are required to pass a FIPS evaluation. These are clarified even more so in the implementation guidance, where CMVP releases guidance and clarification on specific requirements, evidence that's required, how to test specific items. These are documents that should be reviewed while implementing your FIPS into your cryptographic module. Steve already talked about this, but we're going to talk about it again because it's important, just like scheduling, choosing the correct security level. If you choose a higher security level, not only are you going to be having to implement more checks in the actual implementation, but there's also physical security requirements that are required at each level that just escalate up and up, and they get much more difficult as you go up. In network devices, like Steve was mentioning, you're looking at a level 2, which would be basic physical security testing, tamper-evident labels perhaps, or seals, pick-resistant locks and doors and covers. You have opacity requirements to make sure that you can't see the inside of the product and see the cryptographic module. As you move on higher than that, you have non-direct attacks, you have environmental protections at level 4. It gets much more difficult, and it escalates much higher as you move on. So choose the correct level for your product and for your customer don't choose higher. You're not going to get much more out of it. If your customer only needs a level 2 evaluation, then there's no reason to go higher than that. CAVP certificates, yeah, you need those too. You need all the FIPS algorithms that you're claiming in your module. They all have to be FIPS approved, and for an algorithm to be FIPS approved, they need a CAVP certificate. The only exception to this would be the in the implementation guidance, anything that's specified as a vendor affirmation for your implementation. Right now, 856A revision 2, for instance, has implementation guidance for how to claim vendor affirmation, because there is no CAVP testing for that. However, pretty much all of the other algorithms that you can claim that can be FIPS approved can be tested by CAVP, so you need to get your cryptographic algorithm validation program certificates prior to your FIPS testing ending. If you put this off until the last minute, there is a chance that things could go wrong, things could be found in your implementation. If the things are found in your algorithm implementation that are wrong, then there's going to be FIPS testing that's going to have to be redone, your schedule's going to get delayed. We're going to keep drilling in. Schedule is going to be a problem. Plan for schedule early. Plan for FIPS while you're developing your project. These are all important points to take away from these slides. Don't put this off to the end. And more documentation. Yes, there is a lot of documentation that comes with FIPS testing. You have, as I mentioned, the DTR identifies vendor evidence items that are required. Depending on the lab you are working with, this could be as simple as a collection of development guidance, and then the lab will put together the vendor evidence items out of those documents, or the lab may require you to create a supplemental guidance that has a response to each of the vendor items. So this is another reason to choose your lab early, find out how they test, find out the requirements they need from you for documentation and what help they may need for testing or anything else. Plan early, plan to do documents, plan for things to go wrong. Things usually go wrong. It's okay. In the previous slide with CAVP testing, algorithms often fail. It could be something wrong with the formatting of the response files. It could be something wrong with your implementation. It could be something wrong with the test bed that you're using to load the algorithm vector known answers. There's many things that could go wrong. Plan for things to go wrong. Build it into the schedule, and the process will go a lot easier.
Okay, so since he's a lab guy, we decided he shouldn't do this slide. Aren't all labs the same? Well, like I said, sort of. Every one of the labs are accredited. Every one of the labs are technically competent to do your validation. But just like everybody is different, all the labs are different. Labs have strengths and weaknesses. Labs have different styles. And so, for example, one of the points Chris made, which is a really big item, the vendor evidence documentation, which basically lays out how on an assertion-by-assertion basis how you meet the requirement. Some labs say, just toss all you have over the fence, boom. And they will sort it through, and they will produce the vendor evidence and put it directly into the report. Some other labs require, and they give you a form, that they actually pull all the vendor assertions out of the derived test requirements, and you fill out your evidence for each of those items. And so if you have people to do the documentation, it might be quicker and less expensive if you do the documentation yourself. On the other hand, if you don't have people available to do that documentation and who want to learn the process and you've got the spare resource, you may want to choose the lab that just lets you toss it over. On the other hand, if you've got the resource, you may want to do it yourself. Also, things like some labs tend to like to do the testing at their site. Some labs like to do the testing at your site. If you're having something tested on a mainframe, chances are you need a lab that's going to come to you, unless you want to cart it all over there and put in the cooling and everything. On the other hand, some labs are really good at networking stuff. Some labs are really good at hardware. Some labs are really good at software. Shop around. Find the lab that has the style that fits your development structure. And that's really important because, like I've said before, and I'll say it a million times, you need to consider the lab your partner. And so, if the lab is your partner, you really want someone, you know, the same way any relationship you have in your life, you would prefer a partner that sees the world mostly in the way you do. And so you all get along. And that's really important. So the thing is, it's more important than the price is the style. And by the way, for those of you who have not done FIPS yet, and you start worrying so much or start bidding the labs competitively to the dollar, you're really looking at the wrong expense. Because the truth is, your development resource and your documentation resource are going to cost you a great deal more than the lab does. And trust me, I've worn all the hats in this game. I've done all the roles. Trust me, you will spend more internally than externally. So the thing is, the price of the lab may or may not be important to your budget, but if you talk about the overall cost and certainly the overall effect to your validation process, choosing the lab that does things closest to your style is going to get you a lot farther than choosing a lab based solely on what they want to charge you for that validation process. And if there's one thing you take away, that's probably it. And the other thing is start FIPS early. Those are probably the two most important messages that we could give you today. So with that, that's the first part. We didn't get as many laughs as we hoped for. So I don't know. Either it's too early in the morning or we're not very funny. But any questions? Sir. Sunset.
There's one of these hiccups that, oh, by the way, when I started my process to design a pitch requirements, you know, there's new requirements that come out over time, and my product is no longer validatable, so I've got to go back to the drawing.
Absolutely.
You want to talk about that a little bit more, about something like the transitions or standards that are affected by, you know, how this pushes out some of these changes and also that the vendor should be aware of as part of scoping for the validation?
Sure.
From the lab point of view, that's one of the reasons why it's important to have a relationship with the lab early, because they should be providing that information to you as it comes to them. If there's updates to the implementation guidance, if there's sunset dates that are coming up, and you've planned your development cycle, and you've planned your testing window, and it looks like you're not going to hit those sunset dates, the lab needs to be communicating that with you, and they should be. So this is why, another step, why it's important to form a relationship with the lab early, include them in the development process, talk to them about what your needs are, what your schedule is, and they should be giving you those dates and any concerns that they have meeting those schedules with the changes in the guidance.
Another reason for that that supports it is the labs know what's coming a little before we actually get to find out. This is one of these funny things that I now know what I don't know. When I was working at a lab, we would get notices from the CMVP about upcoming expected changes, or we would get drafts of new implementation guidance. And we said the term implementation guidance a couple times. I'll talk about that much more in the next part. But basically, the implementation guidance is a document, a living document. It changes constantly because when it's found that there are items that are not covered sufficiently in the standard or adequately, or that there are, you know, the standard's written at one point in time and the world moves forward and development happens and things are invented, and the standard never envisioned them. So the thing is, you have to be able to cover all these new happenings. So the implementation guidance sorts out these things, potential mistakes in the standard, things that weren't covered, new things that weren't envisioned, all get decided on, and how they will be treated going forward is in the implementation guidance. So the labs get to see the drafts of those add-ons before we do. So the thing is, your lab will warn you if they see something that you're doing may in sometime in the future not be acceptable or may have to be treated somewhat differently. They'll give you the warning. If you're not a lab, you can simply download the copies of the IG as it comes out. You can keep looking at the CMVP website, but you're not going to get it quite as early as you will from the lab. Nithya? Of course, there are. This doesn't happen very often, but there have been cases of new requirements being applied retroactively, and we've had this year one of those that I know made many people pretty unhappy. But the thing is, even if you'd finished your submission and it was in the queue, if you didn't perform certain operations, you had to go back and update your module to meet that requirement. That doesn't happen often, but it does happen as well. And obviously, for those who thought they were done and thought they had met all the requirements and found out that there was a requirement that was expected to come in eventually, but now is being pushed earlier, it was an uncomfortable time. But that does happen, but not often. Let's see. I think you were first, Valerie. Oh, God, yeah. If for folks who didn't hear that, you need to have management buy-in first, last, and always on this. It's going to take resources from the moment you start your project development, development in the very beginning until the certificate's issued, and then you're really going to have someone who answers the calls because you have a contact in the certificate list. So, yes, you need management buy-in first, last, and always. Valerie? You may or may not be able to. If that's what you test and it meets all the requirements, yes, you can.
Can you leverage other people's validation?
Sure.
Like that?
In fact, it's a very common thing, and it's normally kind of referred to as the FIPS inside sort of thing, and the OpenSSL is probably the best example. If you want to use OpenSSL on a platform, you're using the right processor, so the right CPU, right hardware platform, and the right OS platform, that it's already been validated on, and it's open source code like OpenSSL, you can use their executable, and it's considered validated. And there are a lot of people who do that. In fact, one of the things a lot of the labs will do if you want to do that is they will audit your product and see that you have actually applied this existing validated module to your product in a compliant way that meets all the requirements as laid out in the security policy of the module. And then you can claim compliance in the lab. You can usually get a lab to audit that and write you a letter saying that they have found you to be in compliance, and in their opinion, you are compliant using that particular module, and they give you the certificate. And they put the certificate number in the letter.
So next. You said the implementation guidance does not add new requirements. That's not
Yeah, it's
in particular, all the ESD mentioned we have to do today, that was no topic 2 years ago. So if you look at the list of modules, old modules which are older than that, they have no evidence about, most of them, I would assume, have no clear evidence about the entropy of the energy resource. Probably you go with the next revalidation, and then you are now required to have this entropy estimation. It can be in big trouble if you're using just some noise source on an off-the-shelf component, and you, before you just presented what the data sheet said, and now CBP says, no, we want the design, we want you to know all about it.
I have personally felt that pain, trust me.
So,
I am not the person to answer this question. Would any of the CMV people like to make any statement about that?
The IG not introducing new requirements?
I'm sorry,
what? The fact that, okay. Thank you. I appreciate that, because sometimes in these talks, there are times I don't feel like I have any right to speak on certain topics. Sir, thank you for your patience.
Yeah. So you said one of the first couple sentences, the labs have a right to see all your source code. Now, one thing, and this is part.
That's really a requirement, not a right.
Oh, right, requirement. But one thing that's been documented all along, actually, is they even have a right to see your VHD output. So give me a little scenario. Tell me, somebody, give me an answer. How do you get around the problem? You have a hardware designer. He's put a system on a chip on a board for security reasons. This chip has silicone dies from three different manufacturers. One of those dies has a security library from a third manufacturer. That person used IP from a crypto library from a fourth manufacturer. If you don't call 4,000 hardware chips, you don't have an NDA with the guys at the bottom of the pile, how are you ever going to see that code if the lab asks you?
Okay, commercially manufactured chips are not included in that requirement. So for example, we don't need the VHDL for your i7. That's basically stuff that is so pervasive, it's generally permitted. So for example, but on the other hand, there's still been issues with, we have the same thing. For example, a lot, going back to entropy, because that seems to be the problem of the year, a number of the hardware vendors who added entropy sources to their CPUs do not meet the requirement technically, because they don't allow a tap to see the raw entropy data before it's been processed. And so, yes, CMVP's kind of still been giving a buy on those. And if there's algorithm implementations, they just go, you have to go through, if they've never gone through the CAVS test, you're gonna have to take them through CAVS, and we do that over, I mean, as a vendor, I do that now. You know, if we have hardware that we end up taking through CAVS in our implementation. So there are ways around it, and one other way around it is when I was at a lab, there were times when the vendor didn't wanna disclose schematics or, you know, certain source code to the customer, you, so we'd set a separate NDA up with the lab, and that lower level vendor would supply the information directly to the lab, and the lab would incorporate that into the report without the product vendor ever seeing it. And I've been both a customer who's done that and a lab who's received that. So that's the way around it sometimes.
You said commercial, so what's the definition of commercial?
Is that
more than one?
There've kind of been some developments in that, because now that there's the ability to validate a subchip module, you may have to push back on the original vendor of that chunk to go get it validated. If there's stuff that needs validation and they won't share the information with you, they may have to go get that validated as a subchip module. I mean, there are ways around almost all of this stuff, but the thing is, again, that's part of your product planning, that if you want to meet FIPS 140 requirements and get the certificate of validation, and you're using parts that cannot be validated, cannot be verified, cannot be tested, then they're not appropriate for the standard. You know, and it's not the CMVP's fault that your vendor isn't being cooperative. And so the parts still all have to meet the requirements. Yeah, that's happened. And it happens very rarely, but it has happened, and I guess the endeavor going forward is to try to figure out ways to prevent it from ever happening again. And the question, oh, John.
Going back to like three or four questions, so the one over here about operating systems and RNGs. This is the case, if I have some subcomponent, whether it's an operating system or a chip or something like that, that has a validated RNG with certificate issued for it, can I then use that to be the seed for my own RNG and skip the whole entropy analysis type thing?
Yes.
Again,
because if you've got, there's a concept in FIPS of using an embedded validated module, and so if the OS's RNG and its entropy source is a validated FIPS module, and your software running on that OS calls it, that's an automatic checkbox. That's done. They did that. The previous lab did that work. Whether or not the level of scrutiny has changed over time.
Well, that's certainly not been the case recently.
I have done that.
In the past, we've done that with no problem. Currently, that's become more of an issue because since that RNG may have been validated before they did required entropy testing and stuff like that, it doesn't meet IG 714, 715. We have had issues.
Interesting.
So that's, again, one that's still getting sorted out. Is there, Jennifer, do you want to make a comment about that, or should we just let that one sit for the moment? Okay. Yeah, this one's very messy because
if you make a general comment, everybody runs with it.
Right. This is one that has been happening lately. It's been happening in a bunch of different places where people are using an already valid, like for example, using the RNG in a TPM because they use the TPM in a further validated product, and they were using the TPM as the entropy source. But the TPM is a validated RNG, but it doesn't have a non-processed output. So there've been, it's a shaky item right now. And by the way, and in the long run, it would be nice to have some clarification on that.
Let's just point out too that using of an already validated module is you have to be careful in the way you use it, because if you are not using it for a secure channel, for instance, a random number generator, you could use an approved random number generator, but if you're transmitting that data across a network in an unprotected manner, it's not going to work for you.
Oh, absolutely, because in fact, like I said before, when I was...
You have to be careful about your implementation.
You have to use it according to the security policy, so you have to do the implementation. Your implementation using somebody else's embedded module has to meet their security policy, not, you know, so you have to meet all the requirements. Absolutely. Sir.
You say
Okay, right now for FIPS 140, the requirement is local. I've not tried to submit. I have given a CC entropy report for a FIPS submission, and it was not accepted. And I had to rerun the entropy test using the NIST tool. So. Okay, so this is one that's not always settled yet.
We've also submitted several tests. In fact, we do the, actually when our customers have FIPS and CC contracts, we do the entropy looking at the CC requirements because those are different order, and then use that documentation for the FIPS. It's always in the tool.
And I've done that and had one not accepted. I gave my CC, the CC
on a... What they don't accept is a certificate of another national body.
No, this was an entropy report that I had used. No, this is an entropy report that I had successfully used, that NIAP issued the CC certificate. We had started both at the same time. CC finished first. CC had issued the certificate, and we used the same entropy report for FIPS, and it was not accepted. So,
did you change the title?
No, we ended up having to redo the entropy test, and then it was accepted. The delta was the entropy test, not using the NIAP tool and using the NIST tool. So, but since NIAP will accept the NIST tool, we now just do everything with the NIST tool. That's one thing we learned. Any other questions? Let's take a 5-minute break, and we'll come back and start on the kind of how to do it.